The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, just the other day my phone rang. But there was a number I didn't recognise, so I didn't know what to do. Do I take the call? I Googled it. I still didn't recognise the number. What do I do? It could be a spam, it could be scam, or it could be important. Finally, I took a deep breath, and I took the call. And I'm glad I did, because it was someone I knew, and it was important. But who calls these days? Normally, when our landline phone rings, I say to my wife, "That'll be your mum." And she says, "No, that'll be your mum. No, it'll be your mum. It'll be your mum." Because who calls anymore? Because these days we don't talk. And we actually don't know how to talk. So we either shout or we don't talk at all. And we don't talk about important things. And we certainly don't talk about God. But that's okay, because God talks to us. And in the Bible, one big way that God talks to us is he sends his son, Jesus. And Jesus talks to us. Now, I grabbed this photo off the internet. It's not Jesus, but I reckon if Jesus was around today, that's exactly what he would look like. He'll be short, nondescript, tanned, a Middle Eastern male, walking around the countryside of Palestine, speaking Aramaic. And welcome to our February talks. Each week, we'll be looking at a different person that Jesus meets, and we'll be asking this question: what would Jesus say to this person, and what would Jesus say to us? And this comes in a 20-minute talk from me now, and there'll be question and answer time from you guys afterwards. And today, Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well. And our question is this: what would Jesus say to the isolated and lonely? And this woman is a complicated character, because she's of another race. She's of another religion. She sneaks out in the middle of the day where no one can see her, like we might sneak out for a cigarette. And she's isolated and alone. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews don't associate it with Samaritans." This time last year, I went to Indonesia, and I went to this church service, and it was amazing. There was hundreds and hundreds of people on their feet, clapping, singing, chanting, waving their arms in the air. It was such a spectacle. I videoed it, and I uploaded it onto social media. And you know how social media works. The comments go in one direction at the first. They're overwhelmingly positive, amazing, awesome, so happy for you. But social media, bit by bit, the comments will swing and go the other way, and they start going negative. Because what's wrong with that picture? It's only women. So suddenly the comments go, "Where are the men? Typical, lazy, hopeless, staying at home, making the women do all the work." And all the comments start hating and dissing upon the men. But with social media, the comments will go to a third position after a while. And after a while, people started saying things like, "Hang on, I'm pretty sure in Indonesia, the women sit on one half of the church and the men sit on the other half. I'm pretty sure Sam has sat in the wrong section of the church. What a doofus, what an idiot." And suddenly all the comments are hating and dissing on me because I've done a social, cultural, religious fail. And Jesus does a social, cultural, religious fail. He's a Jew talking to a Samaritan, a man talking to a woman, a person of high social standing talking to someone of poor social standing. Why does he do this? Because he has three important things he wants to say to her and three important things he's going to say to us today. Number one, it's okay to get tired. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. This is my favorite verse in the whole Bible, because even Jesus, the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, gets tired. I love my mobile phone because it gives me freedom, autonomy, roaming, but it also means I'm addicted to PowerPoints. When I walked into a room, I'm scanning, looking for a PowerPoint. And just the other day, I went to a cafe and I found the table that is next to the PowerPoint. So I sat down, plugged in my phone, and after a while, another man comes and he wants to share the PowerPoint with me. And he asked me to move over so he can sit on my chair so he can use the PowerPoint. Now, I don't know what the social etiquette is here, but I told him no. And I'm sure even the Good Samaritan in the Bible would not have shared his PowerPoint, because this is a basic human need. Our phones need to be recharged, and Jesus needs to be recharged. He's tired. He has to sit down. He's thirsty. He needs to drink. And he's peopled out. So he sends the disciples into the town to do the shopping while he stays back for some alone time. It's okay to get tired. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It says before we can have self-actualization, we need esteem. Before we can have esteem, we need love and belonging. Before that, we need safety. But above all of that, we need physiological needs. And they put there food, water, sleep. Sleep is a new one. They've only put that in the last 5 or 10 years. When I went to university, they didn't put that in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but now they know sleep is a basic human need. I went to a parenting course a few years ago, and they showed me the peak performance pyramid, and they were trying to say the same thing. Before you worry about the emotion, before you worry about the psychology, before you worry about the wisdom of parenting, you need to look after the bottom one, which was sleep. It's okay to get tired and have a break. And Christians need to hear this, because we've confused busyness with holiness and holiness with busyness. As if I'm busy, I'll be holy and God will be pleased with me. And to be holy, I need to be busy. And so we make our pastors, our deacons busy. We make our young people busy. We make our small groups busy. We make our church program busy. I once went to a Bible college where 1 week a year we do a mission to another church. And I remember the principal saying to us, "Now on this mission, we need to be busy. We needed to be busy." But Jesus says, no, we need to sit down, have a break, have a drink. It's okay to get tired. Number two, Jesus says to us, it's okay to admit our brokenness. Because Jesus tells this woman, Jesus told her, "Go call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had 5 husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." What's going on here? Jesus asked a woman to get her husband. She replies, she's had 5 husbands. Now, if we've had a religious fundamentalist upbringing, this is what we're hearing. We're hearing she's been married 5 times, and she's been divorced 5 times, and now she's living with a man she's not married to. But I've been reading these books, and apparently if you're from an African tradition or from a Middle Eastern upbringing, you're hearing this instead. This poor woman, she's been married 5 times, and 5 times in a row her husbands have left her, and now she's living with a man who won't even do her the dignity of marrying her. This man's just using her for sex, companionship, housework, but won't give her the status or the security of being a married woman. She's a broken woman. Now, a few years ago, I took up boxing for fitness. And if you do boxing for fitness, they make you hit a bag over and over and over and over and over again. And I hit it so many times, my biceps tendon started going weak, and finally it ruptured and pulled itself off the socket. And I needed surgery. And that's when my surgeon told me that the rate of injury in men over 35 taking up a new activity is 100%. You'll be better off just staying at home. But it's not just a new activity. I used to play rugby with a friend at college. And just a few years ago, he thought, "You know what? I'm going to play rugby again, just to show I can." And of course, first game back, he broke his ankle. Now, a broken bone, a broken tendon, a broken muscle is nature's way of giving us feedback. It's nature's wake-up call. It's nature's way of saying, we're not the people we think we are. It's nature's way of saying something is broken, we need to change something. And Jesus asked this woman about her husband's to let her know, you know what, you're broken. That's nature's feedback mechanism. Something needs to change. And she's broken in at least 2 areas. The first area is this: she's isolated and lonely. She's come in the middle of the day where no one can see her because she doesn't want to see anyone and they don't want to see her. She is disconnected. And we in the West right now are very disconnected. This is Catherine Gillespie writing in Vice, and she writes, a loneliness survey finds Australians are very, very lonely. 60% of Australians say they're lonely. 80% of Australians say it is a problem in Australian society. Sebastian Junger, writing in a recent book called Tribe on homecoming and belonging, and he writes how in the West we have no tribe, no home, no belonging, and because of that we have a higher rate of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder compared with other countries where there is a tribe, a home, or belonging. George Monbiot, writing in a recent Guardian article, talks about how the age of loneliness is killing us in the West. Quoting Harvard research, they're saying now loneliness in the West is of an epidemic health proportion. It's as likely to kill us as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and it's twice as deadly as obesity. Our Western individualism is literally killing us because we've been told to disconnect ourselves from each other, disconnect ourselves from tradition, disconnect ourselves from God, but it's not working. We're broken. And the woman's broken in a second area. She has shame in her life. And we in the West have recently moved into an age of shame. John Ronson, TED speaker, author, writing a book recently. John Ronson, so you've been publicly shamed. David Brooks, writing in the New York Times just 2 years ago, talks about how we're in a shame culture. And so what they're saying is we in the West, and other people are discovering this, we have moved into an age of shame. Something really interesting has happened in the West. In the last 100 or 200 years, we told ourselves this. There's no such thing as guilt. Guilt just is made up, arbitrary, social, religious construct. Just get over it. And there's no such thing as God. Just do whatever makes you happy. And so we tried that, and instead it's just made us feel shameful because we know we're not who we should be. We know we need to be better than who we are. We have moral injury, moral corruption. We've seen or done things we should not have had. And so now we have shame. And here's the thing with shame. It's actually very hard to get rid of shame. At least with guilt, there was forgiveness. And at least if we had a God, there was a God who could forgive us. But now with shame, there is no forgiveness. And we can't forgive ourselves because that doesn't work. To forgive, you need, by definition, an external reference point. And right now, our only external reference point is society. And society is very unforgiving. But Jesus says to the woman and to us, you know what? I will forgive. I will take away whatever shame there is. I will heal and I will restore. So Jesus makes the woman face her brokenness to show that he can restore her. Number three, we are thirsty for Jesus. Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. The water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Jesus offers water that gives eternal life. Now, last year, I went through my third midlife crisis and I bought myself a motorbike. And whenever I ride it, I put a high-vis vest on and my wife says to me, oh, you can't wear a high-vis vest when you ride a motorbike. I said, why not? She says, it looks so uncool. And I said, but it makes me safe. And she goes, well, it was about safety. Why'd you buy a motorbike in the first place? And I thought, oh, I hate it when they use logic like that. But anyway, why did I buy the motorbike? Because it promises me freedom, adventure, an identity, a status. And you will roll your eyes and go, oh, come on. It's just a lump of metal that takes you from point A to point B. If you think it's going to give you freedom, identity, and a status, you're going to be disappointed and you will destroy your bike and it will destroy you. But we do that with everything in life. This is water. It's a basic human need. It hydrates us, but we ask more from our water. We want it to give us power, performance, winning, ambition. And if we have all this, then we'll have identity, status, and security. And we will go, oh, hang on, I think it's just water. It's not going to give you any of those things. And if you think it will, you'll be disappointed, you'll destroy the water, and it will destroy you. And we do that with relationships. Relationships, another basic human need. It gives us love and belonging, but then we ask more from it. We want it to give us power, success, aesthetics. We want to be Instagram worthy. We want to be the trophy couple, and it will give us identity, status, and freedom. And then we got to say, well, if that's what you're wanting from your relationships, you're asking way too much, you'll be disappointed, and you're going to destroy the other person, and you're going to destroy the relationship, and it will destroy you. Jesus says, whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Meaning, don't ask too much from these things in life, because only Jesus can give us the water that satisfies. Only Jesus can give us the identity, the status, the security, and the freedom that we're looking for. Jesus gives us eternal life, a full life, a fulfilled life in this life and the life to come. So what would Jesus say to the isolated and lonely? Three things. Number one, it's okay to get tired. Number two, we have to face our brokenness. You can't climb out of a hole until you realize you're in a hole. And number three, come to Jesus and he will fulfill us. He will give us eternal life. Many years ago, I went to a wedding and I sat next to a guy. And by the end of the wedding, we were talking freely. And he said, I'm a lawyer. For my whole life, I wanted to be a lawyer. I studied hard in high school. I got the marks. I became a lawyer. Then he said, and I've traveled the world. My whole life, I've wanted to travel the world. And now I've done it. And I've just bought a house. My whole life, I've wanted to own property. And now I've bought a house. And then he said to me, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You know, I saw in front of me that night a man thirsty for Jesus. See, you and I are thirsty for Jesus, whether we know it or not. And we can try to fill that thirst with other things, but we'll stay thirsty for Jesus. But I know another man. His name is Spiro. Spiro was into finance and investing in his 20s, and he made so much money, he was able to stop work and travel the world in his 30s. But while he was traveling the world, someone told him about Jesus. And so Spiro, from then on, decided to love, worship, and follow Jesus. And then Spiro tells me that he, every now and then, he meets these Christians who say they grew up in a Christian family, and they had parents who were Christians who told them about Jesus. And so for their whole life, these people say, there's never been a day I have not known, loved, or followed Jesus. I have been a Christian my whole life. And Spiro says, do you know what I think when I meet people like this? He says, I envy them. I too wish I could have known Jesus for my whole life. I would have given up everything I made in my 20s if I could have known Jesus earlier. So you and I are thirsty for Jesus, whether we know it or not. And we try to fill that thirst with other things, but we'll destroy those things and they will destroy us. But if we come to Jesus, he will fill our thirst and he will give us a full life, a filled life, a fulfilled life in this life and the life to come.
While people are maybe putting some words to their questions, there are a couple that came up yesterday. Well, you mentioned this idea of guilt and shame. What's the difference between guilt and shame?
Yeah. Guilt and shame, they're both there in the Bible. And it's interestingly, like, we who've been raised in the West, we're very familiar with guilt. But those of us who've been raised in Asian cultures are very familiar with shame. And they're both in the Bible. And it's too simplistic to say, oh, guilt is objective and shame is subjective, because they both have objective and subjective components to them. Easiest way of understanding is guilt. If there's a line here, I'm guilty if I cross that line. So now I'm guilty of an offense and I need to be forgiven, pay a penalty, and be declared innocent. But shame is almost the opposite. If there's a line, there's a standard that I'm expected to meet, and I don't meet it, then that's shameful. Now I have shame. I've fallen short of the expectations that I myself or my tribe or my tradition has set of me. Now I fall short. Now there's dishonor. And the opposite of shame then is to be restored, lifted up, healed, and to be honoured, because the opposite was dishonour, now it's honour, and for God to show his face upon us. And now that we realise, oh, there's a shame category in the Bible, start looking for verses in the Bible, especially in Psalms, where it talks about God showing his face to us, and that priestly blessing in Numbers, where it says, may the Lord bless you, keep you, and may he make his face shine upon you. So it's the opposite of shame. God is now going to take the shame away, restore you, honour you, lift you up, and be pleased in you. So you know that verse where Jesus comes out of the water, he's baptised, or when he's on the mountain, and the Spirit comes down, and God says, you're my son, I am pleased with you. God is honouring his son. It's the opposite of shame. God is showing his face. And it's just a beautiful image in the Bible that if we can rediscover it, oh, I think our Christian life would be so much more rich just to enjoy God's face and pleasure, which is the opposite of shame.
I would ask, but I want to throw it open to the floor. What other questions might you guys have of Sam? Because otherwise I'll keep going. Yeah. Sam, so there's this problem of guilt and shame. They're quite strong feelings. If you feel guilty or if you feel ashamed, like it's very visceral. How can I know that God actually has forgiven me or dealt with my shame? Particularly when I can still feel it.
Yeah.
Does that mean the promises are actually hollow?
Yeah, so how do I know I'm forgiven if I don't feel forgiven? So on the one hand, forgiveness is an objective status. God says you are forgiven, but I don't feel forgiven because experientially, emotionally, my feelings are not caught up with my status. So several things. One, to realise, well, that's where we just got to trust God at his word. It's like when my wife says, I love you, I'm your wife, that's an objective status. I've just got to trust her promise, believe her word. And then also knowing it takes a while for the feelings to catch up, and that's okay. But they talk about spiritual formation or the formation of habits, and just by habitually, daily reminding ourselves of God's love and enjoying his love, bit by bit the experiences will catch up. So maybe two ways of illustrating that. Everyone talks about the day they get married. They're still not used to it. Even saying the word my wife, no one's used to that. But after about 6 months, it comes intuitively. So objectively, you're married. You don't feel married. But after every day, you think, who's this person? Oh, that's right. I'm still in my marriage. Like every now and then, I walk into a room and I scare my wife. She goes, ah! Oh, it's you. I say, yeah, I'm married to you. I live in the same house. So after 22 years, she's still not used to another body in the house. So bit by bit, the emotions will catch up. Also, I have a friend called Heather. She's American, but she moved to Australia about 10 years ago and became an Australian citizen. So now she has the objective status of Australian citizenship. She comes into Sydney Airport. She can choose to line up with the Australians or the non-Australians. She can line up with Australians, but she doesn't feel Australian yet. But the customs officer isn't going to ask her, do you feel Australian? Can you recite the second verse of the Australian National Anthem, which none of us can do? Do you enjoy a Vegemite sandwich? And when Australia plays New Zealand in the rugby, who do you go for? No, she just has to show the passport, and that's an objective status, and the feelings will slowly catch up.
Okay. On the opposite side, could I not feel guilt or shame and still have a guilt and shame problem?
Yeah, I'm sure you could. It's like I could feel American, but I still can't line up with the Americans when I come in through Los Angeles Airport. So the objective status really, really matters. So what is fascinating is, what is guilt, what is shame? And we keep trying to tell ourselves in the West, there is no such thing. There's no such thing as guilt or shame. It's been imposed upon you by someone else, either religion, your parents, or some sort of authority to control you. If we could be brave and real and authentic enough to reject other forms of authority and just be true to myself and be who I want to be, then that's the solution to everything. And that's the current storyline we're told. But they're finding two things are wrong with that. One is, well, how do you have a project of self-improvement if I am already who I want to be? I need to be better than who I am. Then the second problem is, who defines that standard of what is better? It has to be something external to me. It can't be internal to me. So who do I trust at that moment? So we do have to choose our authorities. It's good to reject some authority, but we've got to have some authority. But which authority? And that's why I say, well, how about we go for the God who is prepared to die for us? I think we can trust his standard. That everyone else asks us to die for their standard, but he's a God who dies for his standard so we can meet his standard. So maybe that's the best way of working out what is guilt, what is shame.
Okay. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for Q&A.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.